funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Jerome Weeks, filling in for Chris Boyd. The spy novel was a creation of the 20th century. Joseph Conrad to Graham Greene, Eric Ambler to John le Carré, the list of notable authors who were also spy novelists says a lot about our modern era. It was the Cold War, that incredibly dangerous, tense, 45-year-long stalemate. It was the Cold War that truly made the espionage thriller a cultural document. Yet beginning in 1988 with his novel Night Soldiers, our guest today turned the page back to the 30s and 40s. Alan First's spy novels are all set during the run-up to World War II and to the war itself. He doesn't write about the big earth-shaking operations like the D-Day invasion or the invention of the atom bomb. Nor does he write the Tom Clancy kind of high-tech thrillers that have filled the bestseller lists. First novels emphasize smoky atmosphere and shady characters, the confusions and moral quandaries faced by people caught up in the war. They smuggle weapons or people, they sabotage the enemy's supply lines. These are the nut and bolt clandestine efforts. But as we repeatedly learn in First's novels, including his new one, Midnight in Europe, when everything in the world is at stake, every little thing becomes important. Alan First, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
I was surprised to learn that Night Soldiers was not, in fact, your first novel. You'd written a couple of other thrillers, contemporary thrillers, before that.
So, terrible books.
Terrible books. So what led you to this era, the 30s and 40s? And perhaps more important, having written Night Soldiers, what made you decide to stay there?
It was a very strange experience starting that novel. I was living in Paris. And I had been sort of reading around in the 30s and 40s in the literature of the period, all kinds, spy literature and the rest of it. And I got to be very interested in it. And I decided I want to read a panoramic novel about the 30s and 40s in Europe. Panoramic spy novel. So I looked, and there was no such thing. And I thought, well, I don't know where I got the nerve to do this, but I'll write it. It was completely different than my other books. In fact, so much so that when Publishers Weekly reviewed it, they said, yes, it's the same person, but this is a completely different kind of novel. What I had written about before, I don't know, they were like jokey kinds of books, sex and drugs and rock and roll, and the truth about that is that people didn't much want to read about sex and drugs and rock and roll. It's not what they were after. So, but I had written them. They were published. I guess they were well enough written. Suddenly, I started writing Night Soldiers. I was sitting at a desk in my apartment in Paris looking out the window at the apartments on the other side of the courtyard. And I started writing, and I went wild. I wrote three pages. And I thought, where is this coming from? And then I went, oh, I don't care where it's coming from. And I went right back to work. But it was amazing to me. And I'm going, like, how do I know all this? And I'm a very secular person. I don't particularly believe in channeling or anything like that. But it was very spooky. And it never stopped. When I finished, Night Soldiers does something that my other books don't do. I thought it was going to be the only one I would write, so it went all the way to 1945. It was a big doorstop of a book. And I realized when it was done and when it was published that I was going to write another one. And so I, you know, set about writing another one. This one was called Dark Star. And that one was based on a character not unlike Ilya Ehrenberg, who was Jewish, communist, Russified Jewish Pole. That's what they called him. Who survived Stalin and everything else and wrote novels. So it's a character very much like that in Dark Star, and it just kept going from there. The books were well reviewed. They didn't sell very well. They didn't really start selling till I got on the bestseller list at number 6, which was which was Kingdom of Shadows. And since then, every one of the books has been on the bestseller list, and it turned out to be successful. Meanwhile, the form has changed into a more a shorter kind of form. Somebody said First has taken the existential European novel and made it into a spy novel, and it works, which is not wrong. I was, you know, very taken with the style that Camus had in The Stranger, et cetera, et cetera. So that's how Night Soldiers got written. It was based on experiences I had when I went to Moscow, where I never intended to go, but I was trying to get a visa to write a travel piece for Esquire, which would start at the end of the Danube. But they wouldn't let me go to Ismailia, which is the Russian city at the end of the Danube. They said, you have to come to Moscow and you have to spend 8 days here, or something like that. I forget how much it was. But I had never seen a police state before. And they make no secret of it there. It's not subtle or leak or anything like that. It's right out in front. Things you see, et cetera, and so forth. So that got me going. I had what do I want to say, moral purpose. And this makes me laugh in a way. When I was in college, I had to read for some course Matthew Arnold. And boring doesn't begin to be the word for it. But he says that in an essay. He says that the motor or the energy of a novel should be moral purpose. And it worked for me. I don't think that's true of all novelists. I don't think it's true of all novels. But it worked for me in this instance.
Well, in fact, your books are often praised for their cosmopolitan feel, for their sense of atmosphere and style. And some of that is scenery. Some of it is your characters seem to have a very casual adult attitudes towards sex. But some of that, as I mentioned in the intro, is a kind of moral and political murkiness that they find themselves in. That unlike many very popular spy novels, things aren't so clear cut. I mean, obviously the Germans are generally the villains, but just what to do and why and what you need to sacrifice is often not easy to determine in your books.
All I can say about it is that another reviewer made a point about my books, and he said that there's a question in all of them. It's never stated explicitly, but it's there. And the question is, what would you do? You. Not some character in a novel. You. And I think sometimes people think about that when they read these books. It's not at all clear what you would do, because if you did do something, it was very dangerous. Very, very dangerous.
That is the sort of existential quandary you put your characters in repeatedly, is that somewhere along the line, they have to sacrifice something.
Yes. And there's a famous line from Sartre, his book called Existentialism. He talks about an incident during the resistance where a young man came to him and said, I want to join the resistance. And Sartre said, okay. I might know somebody that can help you. And then the guy said, but I have an elderly mother. I'm the sole support of her, and I take care of her. What if something happens to me? And Sartre said something, I guess, very existential. He said, you'll know what you want to do when you do it.
The focus of so many espionage novels is what they call tradecraft, all the ins and outs of clandestine protocols, procedures, even the technology. But in a number of your novels, your main characters aren't professionals at all. Christian Farrar in Midnight in Europe is actually a Spanish lawyer in Paris. And like your other main characters, he's a reluctant warrior who would be perfectly happy to eat good food and remain in bed with his lover. Why focus on the amateurs?
I'm not entirely sure, but if I think about it, characters have to have biographies. And so who are we really talking about? If you're talking about someone in the 1930s, the United States had no spy service at all. And the Germans had two, military and the Gestapo, which was a political service. And I'm not comfortable with the sort of biography that it would take to have somebody doing that, because that's a difficult business. So I prefer to have the amateur who has to make those kinds of decisions rather than an individual who would be basically following orders.
That's a good point. I hadn't thought of that. As someone who was a professional at that time, the question of sacrifice wouldn't come up so much. They're already kind of a hardened professional.
Yes.
They've already made those choices, those moral choices.
Yeah. So I prefer to stay with the civilians rather than, I mean, I think the only thing you could do with a German operative is have him defect or doubled or something like that. I don't find that so interesting.
Well, there are those Philip Carr novels which have, you know, Nazi detectives in which they basically, it's kind of like the problem of a person in a corrupt totalitarian state. How do you remain moral?
Yeah, I'm not sure how you would go about doing that. I mean, half the German service was very anti-Hitler, the military part, Canaris and all that, and acted against him, and ultimately Canaris paid with his life for the June 21st assassination plot against Hitler. I hope that's a good enough answer. I'm not really sure what it is beyond that, but I want to be closer to the reader in terms of the people in the book. I want the people in the book to be more like the reader. In other words, a lawyer is going to read the new book with interest because it's about a lawyer, et cetera, et cetera. And I work on vocations. So that I've had the captain of a tramp freighter. I've had a couple of journalists.
A film producer.
A film producer. And a film actor, a star, and so on. But they were all professions that were important at the time to the war in some way or another. Because those are the people you read about when you read the books about that period.
In addition to the whole atmosphere and suspense of the spy novels, one of the appeals, I think, of the historical espionage thriller, at least certainly with your books, you've made it such, is the amount of research, the kind of texture, local color, that kind of thing. And I'm always impressed by the way you're able to deliver a fair amount of information to the reader who might not know what Belgrade meant and what Serbia, how Serbia was torn apart, that kind of thing. And you deal with it with a certain, I've said you treat your reader well.
You bet. You have to do that. And I work very hard on that. And the only way I can do it is I learn the political history of that country because I like to move around in countries. I'm in Paris for the time being, and I probably will be in the next book as well. But it takes me, I have a, you know, old encyclopedia close to the war.
We'll have to come back to that, I'm afraid, Alan.
Oh, okay.
All right. You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. My guest is the novelist Alan First, and we'll be back after this break.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Jerome Weeks, in today for Chris Boyd. Our guest today is best-selling espionage novelist Alan First. And if you wish to join our conversation, call 800-933-5372 or try emailing think@kera.org. And Alan, you were talking about the kind of research that you do, that you have an antique encyclopedia.
Yes. And it's very small print and it goes on for pages. And I just keep reading it and rereading it and rereading it and rereading it until I know it. And because only once you know it can you begin to refine it in a certain way and make some decisions about what the reader has to know and what the reader doesn't have to know. I'm very careful about that. I don't like overdoing it. I'll tell you, you'll know enough to enjoy the book. That's what I hope.
One of the things that you'll have to forgive me. I'm going to read a little passage from Blood of Victory, because it's not simply that you give us information. It's the way you give us different information. And this is 3/4 of the way through the story. And yet you're giving us this kind of scene setting, that kind of background. But it's the way you do it that's very telling. It goes, Belgrade, or so the British cartographers called it. To the local residents, it was Beograd, the capital of Serbia, as it had always been, and not a place called Yugoslavia, a country which some diplomats made up for them. Still, when that was done, the Serbs were in no shape to object to anything. They'd lost 1.5 million people, siding with Britain and France in the Great War, and the Austro-Hungarian army had looted the city. Real, old-fashioned, neoclassical looting. None of this prissy filching of the national art and gold. They took everything. Everything that wasn't hidden and much that was. Local residents were seen in the street wearing curtains and carpets. 10 years later, some of them going up to see friends in Budapest were served dinner on their own plates. And I love that example because I think it cuts to some of the cosmopolitan feel is there's a certain sympathy, but also a certain shrug as that's war. That's what it's like. And it's a lot of data, setting the scene. And yet it, as I said earlier, it treats the reader well. It's amusing. It's informative, but it's entertaining, too.
It has to be. It just has to be. I have observed that from the time you're 6 till the time you're in your middle 20s, your job is to tell the world how much you know. But if you want to write a novel, that's not what you're there for. You are there to entertain the reader. You are there to entertain the reader. And that starts with the cover. It starts with the title of the first chapter. It starts with an epigraph, if there's one, and it starts then in the first paragraph. I'm after the reader. I am. I call myself a high escape fiction writer. Because it is escape fiction. That's what it's meant to be. Novels of consolation or whatever you want to say. I'm there to take you away from where you are, wherever that is, and put you in a very different place so that you don't think about it so much.
Speaking of the covers, I think it was a very smart move of your publisher, Random House, to do the whole series in these very evocative period photos. They help set the kind of noirish mood for the novels, often of regular people. There's nothing that necessarily says spy or military about them. But the whole dark streets, that kind of thing, is really beautifully evoked by those covers.
Well, I started out using Brassai. And my editor at the time, who was Anne Godoff, wrote to Madame Brassai in Paris, who's 91 years old, got the permission, and a letter saying, please don't put too much print on them. And we went from there to, now this person I can never remember, but he was Hungarian also. And we went through all of those, and then we had to start looking at photo archives. But I will say, there is a brilliant art department at Random House, and they deserve much credit for as much success as I've had.
Now, the new book, Midnight in Europe, is set during the Spanish Civil War, not during World War II. And you've touched on the Spanish Civil War in a previous book, but this is the first time we really sort of get into it. We actually go into scenes in Spain. And I was wondering, when I was reading your novels early on, I was sort of wondering, when do you get to the Spanish Civil War? Because it really is kind of the introductory chapter for everything else that followed.
Yeah, that's true, and that's what I decided to do this time. So that, what I'm really doing is writing about Spain. I'm writing about Paris, though. This is a Paris book, and in Paris, they in fact called themselves the Paris Front. that was involved in trying to do various things to help Spain. Because Spain was in difficulties, and the Republic was going to lose that war. Lose it they did, and Franco stayed in power until something like 1976. He was there a long time, and the country was a fascist country. And if you went there, you could feel it.
There's a map in Midnight in Europe. In the beginning, it's to help people locate things. But I was looking at it, and I realized it's sort of a map to all of your novels. It's Europe from Spain to Poland, Germany to Turkey. And I was wondering, you go to different areas. Obviously, you've had set them in Poland, for instance. And we've had, as you mentioned earlier, a kind of tramp steamers, things like that. Is this just in general reading you come upon these different locations, different avenues to explore?
No, I know in the beginning approximately where I want the book to happen, but the book moves. It goes to different places, and that's just me as a writer. I'll be sitting there doing something or other, and I'll say, all right, time to get out of here. I'll need to have a plot turn here to get everybody off to a different place so I can be in a different place and talk about different things. I must add that I lived in Europe 10 years, all added up. I lived, I think, for 7 years in Paris and a cumulative 3 years in various periods of 3 to 6 months. And I learned about Europe by osmosis, which I think maybe is the only way that I could have learned about it. It's not something you can find in books. Much of what's in my novels has to do with daily life in Europe, which is quite different now than it was in 1940, except in Eastern Europe, which kind of stayed like it had always been. They didn't, you know, when the satellite states were not encouraged to rebuild very much, they managed. But basically, it was the Russians telling them what to do, and the Russians taking all the stuff out of the country, food or whatever else, minerals, workers, whatever else they had. The German Nazis were very, very predatory, and no nonsense about it. There were instances where, yes, people did, you know, did things off the books, et cetera, but mostly not. So that's why I write about Europe. I think people also like to read about Europe. So I write about it.
I once interviewed Stephen Harrigan, a historical novelist. He wrote The Gates of the Alamo. And he told me that in terms of historical detail, if you needed to find out, you know, what particular weapon looked like and how it operated, or what was the hat made of goat skin or lamb skin, he says, you can find that out. He said, but what the novelist really needs to find it is, what was the felt life like? What did life feel like then? What did it taste like, smell, that kind of thing?
True.
Where do you find that?
In books. You know, I like books by journalists of the period who typically would spend, you know, English and American journalists would spend, say, 3 years in Bucharest, and then they'd go back to London or New York, and they'd write a book. This is in the 30s, and it was always called Fire Over Europe, or Europe and Europe Will Be in Flames, something like that. They were well-read books. Nobody believed them particularly. but that's one place where I get a lot of information about what people were feeling at the time and what they were doing. I read technical books which have all kinds of things in them that are very, very telling. There's a book I have. What's his name? Adam Tooz, I think. T-O-O-Z. I'm not sure about the first name. And it's a book about the economics of war in Germany. And he talks about one of the reasons it was difficult for the Germans to move across Russia was that they only, these were, basically these wars were fought by people from farms and factories, and they didn't know how to drive. And the Germans didn't have enough gasoline for them to try, practice 10 hours to learn how to drive a truck. That's not enough. That's not enough. I mean, that was the reason for Blitzkrieg. That was a horse war, World War II. Mostly horses, really.
I remember seeing a photos, Len Dayton put a book out, and it was kind of shocking to see photos of the supposed, you know, mechanized warfare of Hitler. And this was photos of the invasion of Poland, and they were hauling the artillery with horses.
Sure they were. Yeah, they didn't. That was the transport that was available, A. B. It's also pointed out in some book that the German horses were great big horses, cavalry horses, you know, almost like from Austria-Hungary. And it was hard to find anything for them to eat, whereas the Russians had what were called panje ponies, P-A-N-J-E, and these are small, tough, wiry horses who will eat anything. Big difference.
We have a question from Sam in Fort Worth that's relevant to this topic. He said, did Mr. First major in history at college?
I've never taken a history course.
What else did he study and what college?
I went to Oberlin, where I was very insecure type student who majored in English because I knew I could do reasonably well in it. But that wasn't really what I liked. I later discovered, later, meaning my junior year, anthropology. And that taught me a lot about how to be a writer, because what anthropology is about is seeing the world through other eyes. Not everybody has the same, not everybody calls the same people uncle and aunt at all. And on and on and on and on. It was invaluable to me. I later briefly, for a year, studied with Margaret Mead, who's the smartest person I've ever met, and in fact was asked by her to come to work for her at some point, which I decided I couldn't do because that would have meant sitting in a straw-thatched hut somewhere writing down who called who uncle and who called who aunt. That wasn't what I wanted to do.
We mentioned earlier the influence of the existential novel in the 40s and 50s on your work, but it's also hard not to think of things when you're reading these novels, to think of things like Casablanca or the period Hitchcock. I'm thinking like The Man Who Knew Too Much or something like that. Are those influences, are those in your head when you're composing?
Well, what, it's all in my head, I think. The way either writers work or the way my head works, I'm almost like simultaneously listening to Duke Ellington or, you know, the music of the period is so evocative. That's just to do with the 30s. You can't hear four bars of Glenn Miller without being transported someplace. You just can't. Same way with black and white film from various places, France, England, United States, whatever I can get a hold of. I like films. And books, meaning novels of the period, not so much poetry, certainly autobiographies of people like Simone de Beauvoir. But there's a lot there. There's a lot out there. I don't really think I'm ever going to run out of stories. And I continue to read history in all kinds, you know, in all its different forms.
Are there family memories? Did you have family members who told you about their experiences during World War II?
No. I generally don't use human resources. There are people who have written me emails telling me part of their story or saying, I would like to tell you my story. And I generally decline to do that. And the reason for this is that if I don't use the story in my book, I'm afraid they're going to feel bad, that their feelings will be hurt because their story wasn't as good as this other story or something like that. So I try not to do that. And I don't use diaries. I don't think I use any primary materials at all, except what I come across. Do you know what I mean? Like a book written in 1937, I guess that's a primary source. But I don't read collections of letters and stuff like that. What I do read, though, a lot of times people who were through this, who experienced it, wrote and self-published or more likely published with small presses their book. That's so important, I can't begin to tell you, because if you write a book and self-publish it or whatever you do with it, it goes to the Library of Congress and it's cataloged, and then that experience and that history is there for people like me who come along later and read it.
We're talking today with Alan First about his espionage novels, and you can join our conversation by calling 800-933-5372 or by emailing us at think@kera.org. We'll be back with more from Mr. First after a short break.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Jerome Weeks, in today for Chris Boyd, and our guest today is Alan First, the author of such novels as Midnight in Europe and The Spies of Warsaw. If you wish to join the conversation, call 800-933-5372 or email us at think@kera.org. As I said in the introduction, you, when you're writing about World War II, you generally seem to skirt the big things like Operation Barbarossa or the Manhattan Project, things like that. Is it simply because those have been done to death and everyone would probably know that? Or are you simply attracted to the kind of, you know, street-level espionage?
Well, I handle the big, some big operations. The Polish officer, for example, is very much about Operation Sea Lion, which was the German attempt, failure, to invade Great Britain, and others. And I certainly write about Barbarossa in all kinds of ways.
Well, you kind of skirt them.
Doesn't happen on the battlefield,
right? You touch on them, but it's not, the book really isn't about Barbarossa.
No, that's correct. It's absolutely true. And World War II comes in two parts. There's everything up until 1942, and then when the Germans were beaten at Stalingrad, everything changed, the whole view of people in Europe, because at the beginning, it was, what are we going to do about this? And now it's going to be, well, how do we survive until the end? Because the end is coming.
Hmm.
Very different. And I prefer to stay, I'm almost universally before 1942, except for Night Soldiers.
Why? What is the difference in attitude? How does that, would it affect a novel?
I like the idea of people being overwhelmed by circumstance. I'm not the only novelist who feels that way. Mm-hmm. And that's what happened from 1933, really, with Hitler coming into power all the way up through the Stalin purges, followed by the Spanish Civil War, followed by invasion of Poland in 39, followed by France falls in 1940, followed by the attack on the Soviet Union by Adolf Hitler. Those are really the work points in my books, and I don't go much past 42. I never go past 42, and I very rarely go before 1933. The world really changed. The Depression was everything from 1929, and it was still going in 1933. One reason that Hitler was able to take power as he did was the economic misery, real misery, in Germany. Just as bad as it gets. Huge and hyperinflation, suicide, all the things that the end of an economic life where you never thought that was going to happen. And there were a lot of people like that. Some of them, a lot of them, the men had fought in World War One. And felt cheated that they hadn't won, and that Germany should have won, and that all this terrible stuff should never have happened to them. So they were going to try it again. Nobody else wanted to try it again. The French were shot. They were finished. They tried in World War II, but they were like... There's a great book about that. I can't think of the title. By Ted... It's an anagram of a French name, but I can't remember it. Anyhow, it's a very, very interesting book about what became of the French psyche up to 1940 and why that happened. Mm. Shouldn't have happened. They had a huge land army. They had a navy, and they lost in 3 weeks or something like that. Mm.
Let's take a comment from Mindy in Plano. Mindy?
Hi there, Jerome, Mr. Weeks. I love your program.
Thank you.
I'm so excited to have you on the radio today, Mr. Hurst. I was speaking with somebody last night who was telling me about what history book and mystery book she was reading, and I said, no, let me recommend one to you that'll change everything. And just here you are today, Mr. Hurst. I've been such a big fan as a history fanatic myself, but I love your take with the anthropology. It means so much to help me as a reader step in even deeper than most people and just think, God, how big this world is and how old it is and how there's so much happening all at once, and here it is in a book.
Oh, thank you. What a nice compliment. Thank you so much.
Oh, I mean, it's such a refreshing reminder when I have read you and shared it with others to say, oh, my gosh, and it's all true. This is fiction, but it's still all true. It's amazing, you know?
Yeah, so. Well, that there's a good reason for that, why it's all true. I can't write a plot.
Mm-hmm.
I can't. You know what it comes out like? It comes out sounding like a plot that somebody made up for a novel.
Right.
So what I do instead is I let history write the plots. And history writes better plots than any novelist, or better or worse or more extreme plots than any novelist could even imagine.
Yeah.
And the same with details. For a rather grisly one, there came a moment in the Spanish Civil War when the Republic Army was hiding behind tombstones in a cemetery and fighting back against the Franco's army, and Franco's army began to use mortars. And these mortar shells went into the cemetery and exploded and blew the bones up out of the ground so that they landed on the people who were doing the fighting. Mm-hmm. You can't make that up. And I didn't make that up. That happened. And on and on and on, with many of the most interesting things you'll find. I didn't make them up at all. I read about them.
You know, but the tragedy of, and I'm not even 30, but the tragedy of my generation is we don't see the stories behind the history. We just see the things that are in the books and maybe if they're in a movie. And it's, you know, the way we study history has changed so much. So thank you for making it come alive in such real ways. That's really all I wanted to say today.
So thank you, Mindy.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
You mentioned earlier how much you valued memoirs and people's personal books. On a personal note, my father served as an artillery officer in World War II and in Korea, and he wrote a memoir that never got published, but I read it, and it struck me that you often do not have Americans as main characters. And reading my father's memoir, it struck me, I love the man, but he was incredibly naive and innocent. I mean, he was from a farm in upstate New York. And if that's the way Americans approached the war, and so many of them must have, it was a rude awakening to history. They were completely unaware of what they were facing.
I know. Why is that? For some reason, Americans were, for one thing, they had this wonderful barrier between them and Europe, the Atlantic Ocean. And they had their own views about Europeans, you know, all that squabbling over in Europe. Well, we're not going to get involved in that. They really didn't understand that if it was victorious in Europe, it was like going to come here some kind of way. But they thought that was impossible. That could never happen. Consequently, Congress didn't like, you know, Roosevelt tried to get Congress to, you know, pay money to build more weapons. No, couldn't be done. He had to find some other way. Eventually, yes, they did it. But America was not behind the British and French efforts in World War II. Yeah, sure, plenty of them were, people who knew about history, but it was not a large portion of the population.
I could see how having an American character, you would have to keep sort of cluing him into everything. It would be primarily about his education and just as kind of the basics.
Yeah, or it would probably wind up being an expatriate American who lived in Europe and knew Europe.
He'd already learned a lot.
Migrants have to know Europe, and they are European. They're as European as I can make them.
Yes, there's a certain amount of – they carry their history.
They do, indeed. They are quite different than Americans in many ways. And a lot of history has happened to them. Our history isn't all that long. You know, it sort of starts in the 1600s with early settlements and whatnot. But European history goes way back and repeats itself.
And now we're picking up Ray, who wanted to discuss something. Ray, are you there?
Yes, I am. I appreciate the topic of conversation. And just as a setup, my father was born in 1922 in rural Louisiana. So he was one of those naive kids that went off to the war. And I've read two autobiographies. One is a German man, and the name of the book is Mind in Prison. And also one from a Soviet peasant. And I don't recall the name of the book at the moment, but the thing that kind of caught me on all of them was that they were both born in 1922, so I could sort of, you know, transpose my father on them. Anyway, I was just wondering if you'd read any of those or seen anything like that, the Mind in Prison in particular, because it really describes this young man's kind of a trip through the Hitler Youth and Nazism and then his recovery post-war.
I have read that. Those are rare books like that. For one thing, they were hard to get published after the war, I think. But I will write it down, and I will see and have a look at it. So thank you for letting me know.
And Doug in Dallas, you wanted
yes,
to...
Hello?
Doug,
hello?
You're on.
Yes, I'm here. I just had a question. I have not read any of your novels, but I would like to begin. Is there any particular place one should start, or is there a chronology to the stories?
There is no chronology. You can start anywhere you like. I have a website, and each of the books has a description. And
okay.
So you would have to maybe pick on that basis to see if that part of the world interested you. Or maybe it doesn't. Maybe you'd be more interested in some other place. Otherwise, I tend to always recommend my most recent book, which is Midnight in Europe, now soon out for sale in a bookstore near you or any other way you get it.
Very good.
I They don't. You don't start with book one, anyhow. I wouldn't. People start where they start, you know, and that's often because somebody gives them a present, or they go to a bookstore, and what's in stock is my particular XYZ, whatever novel that is. But I don't have a starter novel.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
You don't have a single one that you recommend you think that everyone would benefit from?
No, because they're different. People who have read all my books, a lot of them really like The Polish Officer, mm-hmm. which is really, for whatever reason, came out to be a very, very good book. It's a slightly demanding book. It's not the most cheerful book. I couldn't believe it when I wrote Mission to Paris. Mission to Paris is, for some strange reason, a very happy book. And I don't quite understand why that is, but I felt it as I was writing it, and people told me they felt the same thing after they'd read it. But, you know, this is taste. When people read my books, especially friends, and they say, oh, I haven't read your book yet, and I go, oh, don't worry about it. I don't want book reports from friends, you know, because they might not like the book. What I like to say is that some people like clams, and some people like olives, and some people don't like clams or olives.
I was telling someone describing Midnight in Europe to them, and I said the thing that's remarkable is how he keeps up a degree of interest, sort of suspense, but there are only two kind of action sequences. I mean, the novel's basically about how to get a train to Warsaw and how to get a boat to Spain. That's really what happens, and yet you don't have that kind of clock ticking suspense thriller aspect to the book. Nonetheless, it is something of a page turner. You want to find out what happens next, and I'm sort of amazed that you can do that.
Well, thank you. I don't know.
I want to know the secret. How do you keep interest when the train is going to Warsaw and they're having problems trying to deliver it, and that's the kind of conflict and interruptions and things that you expect. But when that's over, I mean, we go to something else, and yet we're still sort of interested. What's next? What's next?
Well, I mean, that's part of genre fiction. People who write genre fiction, and I do write genre fiction, more or less. And one of the tricks is to keep things moving right along. Don't dwell too long in any one place. And, you know, keep the reader interested in what's going to happen next. But how you do that, I honestly don't know how I do it. It's all very instinctual with me. There's no rules that I have.
I think it's because you keep that moral question hasn't been resolved yet. We're sort of aware that this hasn't been settled. Even if the train gets to Warsaw, the issue for the main character isn't settled yet.
Right, that's true. I like to do those kinds of scenes as scenes, but I can't imagine doing a whole book about getting a train from Skoda Arms in Czechoslovakia up to the docks in Gdansk. I suppose I could do it if I set out to do it, but I don't really necessarily like those kinds of novels too much. I don't write thrillers.
Our guest today has been Alan First, the author of Midnight in Europe. Thanks again for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. And you can contact us via email at think@kera.org. Once again, thanks for listening and have a great day.